This is a paid message from GoFundMe. Meet Juan Naula. When his son was hospitalized for a viral infection, Juan started a GoFundMe to pay for medical expenses.
It was $5,000 to pay the bill for my son, and I needed only 22 hours. It was amazing. People really trust on GoFundMe.
How did Juan raise $5,000 in less than a day? He posted a short video on GoFundMe, telling his story in 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Be specific, be quick, and tell what are you going to be using the funds for. I was nervous to do it because it doesn't feel okay to ask money, but you shouldn't be nervous. Sometimes you just have to do it and see the results. We were able to save my son's life. Thanks to GoFundMe that we still have my son with us.
Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This message reflects one person's experience.
Alive and kicking.
With Claire McKenna.
On News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com. I always love to hear from you. Or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, as the weather improves and summer truly feels on its way, a reminder to mind your skin. How to cope with empty nest syndrome. We have a listener dilemma tackled by our therapist, Fiona Brennan, and writing facilitator and author, Lara O'Brien, on the power of a prompt and community. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm good. After the busiest week of the year so far last week, and that's certainly saying something this year, I emerged unscathed and rather grateful. My pledge at the start of the year, although, as you know, I don't make New Year's resolutions, was to be a little bit more organised with my time. I want to try and embrace my planning diary a little bit more, get back into the lists, and most importantly, my plan was to hang a wall plan calendar on my wall so that I could see the weeks and the months and say yes and no to events accordingly. Well, I'm ready to confess in May that the wall planner is up. Fairly recently did I get it together to get the blue tack and get it out and get it on the wall, but it's still empty. And the diary has one page of planning lists in it. But acceptance is half the battle, isn't it really? And as I say, we've now hit May and I've yet to embrace this version of myself fully in 2026. But I do believe there is still time and it's never too late to make a change. And last week is my case in point. I definitely said yes too many times. I had my daughter's drama show, then headed away for the night with two friends. I had two speaking events, one on Tuesday night, one on Wednesday night, a corporate talk on Thursday before I headed off to Tipperary to a wedding and then back where I had tickets to a show in the Three Arena on Friday night. I mean, that's just bananas, isn't it? And maybe the wall planner would have tapped me on the shoulder and said, whoa. Thankfully, the rest of the weekend was clear and I did manage to recoup all that I had given, apart from the usual commitments. But when I look back, there's not much there I would have wanted to say no to, and I loved each and every experience. But look, I was wrecked, and what's important is a yes always brings a no elsewhere. Either the gym class is gone, I ran out the door one evening barking orders at the kids about sorting out their own dinner. I ate no dinner myself that evening. I mean, it's hardly suffering, but it is a bit silly by times. So I am going to say again a pledge with you guys holding me accountable to write a few things down this week and have a long, hard look. I do say yes to life a lot, but at what cost? I'd love to hear your thoughts on saying yes and what it means you are saying no to. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. I also had my wisdom tooth taken out this week. So hopefully, as I've three left, there will still be enough wisdom to carry me through. And if it is something that you're looking at getting done, just having the one out didn't seem to be that taxing. After watching my husband go down badly, after having two of his out at the same time, likewise my best friend, I seem to have come out relatively unscathed. So if you're just having the one out, I say don't worry. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month. Largely preventable, it's the most common form of cancer in Ireland. Aisling Cleary is Clinical Director of the Laser and Skin Clinic, and she joins me in studio now. Aisling, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
I feel like people sort of eye roll when they hear this, and they're like, we know, we wear, you know, sunscreen, SPF, it's very important, but I still don't think we take it seriously enough, do we?
No, I don't think so. And I think there is, particularly in Ireland, kind of a sense of, well, I use my sunscreen when I go on holiday, but the rest of the year, you know, I don't need to. And I think that's, again, we don't get a lot of sunshine in Ireland in the, you know, particularly in the winter, but it's not just UV, you know, UVB rays, it's also UVA rays. So I think if you, you know, there's also that sense of, ah, well, if I get skin cancer, it's really easily treated, which it is. 90% of skin cancers are treatable. But I think there is just a very lax attitude around skin cancer. And I think the purpose of Skin Cancer Awareness Month is to get people to go, okay, let's stand up and pay attention here, particularly for children. Younger adults, the incidence of cancer is increasing as well for skin cancer. So we want to get the message out there. It's easy. It's not that difficult. Pop your sunscreen on. If, you know, people who work outdoors, don't forget to, you know, put sunscreen behind your ears. Golfers, we see a high incidence of melanoma on the back of legs. People who drive a lot, just put your sunscreen on. But particularly our children, like, you know, educate them. So teenagers should be popping sunscreen on if they're out for the day, if they're playing sport. And to tell them it's not about preventing just getting burnt. It's about preventing cellular damage and the formations of cancer.
Yeah. And, you know, we tend to wait until a really sunny day. But if our kids are playing a match and it's anyway a fair day, should we be putting it on all year round?
We should. And you know what? It's quite interesting. A lot of the younger generation look at the UV index now, which I never heard of until quite recently in the last number of years. So even on a cloudy day, if you look up the UV index and if it's over 3, we should be putting sunscreen on. So again, kids out on the soccer field, playing hockey, playing tennis. You know, the way you'd pop out in the morning, might play for an hour. That's enough to cause damage as well.
Sunbeds are huge as well, aren't they still? And you'd think they would have really gone out of fashion with the way fake tan has changed over the years. I mean, I put some on going to a wedding recently and I'm like, the difference, you don't smell of biscuits, you don't have to go to bed one colour, wake up completely the other with streaks you can't do anything about. Why would anybody get on a sunbed?
You know, that is such an interesting question because it is hugely popular with the kind of early 20 age profile. I think there is, you know, there's a very body conscious, we're very body conscious now. There's a lot of people going to the gym. There's a lot of guys going to the gym. Men particularly don't want to bother with fake tan. Younger girls, it just looks good. It's, you know, it's even. And I think there's a huge influence from the celebrity culture as well. It shocks me because you have a 75% increased risk of developing skin cancer when you have one sunbed. So
wow,
why would
huge.
You? It's huge. It's
and
huge.
It's illegal for under 18s, but this isn't being upheld everywhere.
No, it's not. And it's really interesting. I parked my car one day, seeing is believing. There's a place where I was picking something up and there's a sunbed salon there. And in, I'd say over a 20-minute period, I sat in the car. I would say there was 15 people in and out that door and they were all very young looking. So they do, I know regulation is you have to be ID'd, but I think they just ask date of birth in a lot of these salons. They don't physically look at an ID.
Yeah, and people just might need to make an informed choice. And you can't put sunscreen on getting onto a sunbed, can you? Does that make any difference?
I don't know. It makes absolutely no difference, really. You know, if you think about the studies and the lights and the penetration and the newer sunbeds on the market are even stronger. Yeah.
And we don't know enough yet about the UV lamps in nail salons, do we? I remember a couple of years ago research coming out that cells were shown to change, but it's only research in its infancy.
It's in its infancy and there hasn't been much published since. So I couldn't comment on that. Mm. I don't know enough. I'm guilty of getting my own nails done. But I think what's brilliant and what's great about science is that they're constantly investigating. They're constantly looking at statistics. Even in Ireland, if you look at the stats, skin cancer will double by the year 2040 unless we make changes. So again, putting on the hat, putting on the sunscreen and doing lots of body checks. And again, I think this is a really important message to instill in our children from teenage years on. Just keep checking weekly. And I think that's important because we're fair, we're Irish. And even, you know, we like to have that little bit of a glow, but watch those moles, watch those freckles for the changes.
What changes are we looking out for?
So there's a really simple thing to do. And I always say it's A, B, C, D and E. A, look for the asymmetry. B, look for border. So look for like a little mole if there's changes around the border. C, look at colour if there's any changes. D, diameter if it's bigger than 6 millimetres. And E, evolving, which is if it's changing. Or anything that just isn't healing, or if you have a little spot that, you know, keeps bleeding or is scabby or just doesn't look right. I call some of them the ugly duckling. If you have one that just looks different from everything else, go to your GP or pop into skin check and get them looked at.
Yeah, and I know from having a biopsy myself, I would get my moles checked regularly. They don't have to be brown in colour.
No.
So anything that looks like a little dry spot that, you know, no matter how much moisture you put onto it, it still stays.
Exactly.
That's a change in your skin. So it's just keeping an eye on things like that.
It's keeping an eye. And I think, you know, if you get ahead, if you check, like you can also have like, we had a client recently who had a little spot on her nose. It kept bleeding. So we popped her in and got her looked at in skin check. And it was a precancerous mole. So vigilance, just keep looking. And I think, you know, the way in Ireland we're great. We are now, you know, a culture that we have all got really good teeth, and so do our children. Okay, and we now listen and get our teeth cleaned twice a year, and we practice gum health. If you go back to the 70s, this was relatively new, and I think this is where we want to bring skin cancer awareness. We want to get people coming in, getting their checks done at least yearly. We want them to, you know, be proactive if they have a lot of pigmentation, to go, you know what, I'm going to get some of my pigment removed, because a lot of the new generation of lasers have been proven to reduce precancerous cells, particularly CO2 laser. So there's lots of, you know, there's lots of education to be done. But I think as a country, we're eager and we do look at the stats. So we have to keep spreading the message.
Yeah. So the same way as we brush our teeth in the morning and evening, let's just put the sunscreen on before we head out the door. Yeah. Finally, is there anything we need to know about the quality of the sunscreen? Sometimes I find that a bit of a minefield, what to look at on the bottle, or yeah, are there the bigger names that you just know you can trust?
There are bigger names that you can trust, but I always say to clients, find something that you like. Okay, so in other words, something that you know you'll use every day. I can't. So you've got physical sunscreens, which are zinc-based, and then you've got chemical sunscreens, which are a blend of chemicals, or you can do a combination of broad spectrum. I would always say look for a broad spectrum because it's got UVA and UVB protection. But most importantly, find a sunscreen that you like. So I use mine in the morning. I brush my teeth and I pop it on and then put the rest of my skincare, layer it on top of it. So if something's too thick or gloopy, you're not going to wear it. But if it smells nice and it feels nice, we're more inclined to use it.
And something I learned years ago on R&D AM that I was guilty of and that I stopped doing, we have to buy new sunscreen. I know things are expensive and it's the cost of living, but don't pull out the one you had in the beach bag last year. Get a new one. They have a sell-by date.
They do. And that's really, really, really important. They have a sell-by date and they lose their effectiveness. So every year, invest. And they're not expensive. You know, if you look at some of the sunscreens now, you can get a really good facial sunscreen for €20, which will last you maybe 4 to 6 months, depending how much you're using it. But if you're using it every day, but I definitely would say get one, particularly if you have teenage kids, get one that feels good on their skin, or adults, it doesn't make a difference, and that they can pop on, that feels good and they can go about their day.
Brilliant advice. Thank you so, so much. Aisling Cleary, Clinical Director of the Laser and Skin Clinic. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk. Alive and Kicking. on News Talk.
Every month or so, we have our Therapy from the Couch series with our resident therapist, Fiona Brennan. If you have a life dilemma that you would like her to look at, you can email anonymously aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. And Fiona joins me on the line. Fiona, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire. Happy to be here as always.
And this is quite a good one. As I said before the ad break, empty nest syndrome. I think it's something parents seem to brace themselves for from the maternity ward.
I think so. Yes, definitely. Definitely. And it's something I can really relate to, this listener. I can, you know, I'm at a similar stage in life, so I can totally see where they're coming from.
Well, let me read what came to us and we'll take it from there. So, dear Claire and Fiona, my daughter is in fifth year and she started talking about her college plans and she's really excited about it. However, I find that I just can't bring myself to celebrate the prospect of her leaving home. She wants to go to another country and I'm trying to talk her out of it. I'm already feeling this sense of loss and uncertainty about her moving on. Where will I fit into her life then? I don't want there to be a distance between us and I'd like to be happy for her, but I'm also a single mum and I feel the loneliness would be much more evident if she moves out. I mean, there's so much in those 10 sentences, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I think the first thing, Claire, is to acknowledge, you know, that she is a single mum and, you know, that is very significant in terms of the bond that they must have, you know, over all of these years together. So there's a real sense of understanding the loss that she feels in terms of, you know, going from having her there and then this, what seems like such a frightening prospect of her not being in the house anymore, especially as she's been the sole, you know, the sole everything. You know, I'm not a single mother, but I can imagine, well, first of all, I can't imagine how hard it is and what an incredible strength and courage it takes. And then also how deep that bond must be between the mother and the daughter. So I think that's the first and most important thing to acknowledge, which brings me to really a sense of self-compassion for herself in this, in terms of it is very understandable that she feels the way that she does. And, you know, there really needs to be space for her to go through this. It's like what she's really going through is anticipatory grief, which we feel when someone is very ill, for example, and we're worried about that when they might die, if it's going to be soon. And although, of course, thank goodness, this is not the same thing in terms of a death, but it can feel similar in that sense of loss. But perspective is so helpful here in terms of the realization that this loss is more of a perception than a reality, if you like, that it's more of a transformation. And I know that is helping me because my son is now he's about to do his leaving cert in, God, it seems like days, weeks, very, very soon. And, you know, he is of very much of the mind. He's applied to go to college in France. So he, we hope, is going to be not just moving county, but moving country. And I think that, you know, there is this awareness that helps in terms of how proud a parent can be that they have a child like this daughter. Like my son, you know, has that adventurous spirit and has that, you know, strength and faith in themselves that they want to go abroad. And that's not for everyone, or to go to a different county. It's not for everyone, but it is something to recognize as a parent that, you know, that is really a very good sign of you having done a good job, especially for a single mom. I think it's very inspiring.
Yeah. And I mean, I was watching something online about a relatively new mum. She's pregnant and has a toddler. And she was saying, I used to have no fear, but now since I became a mom, I just see danger everywhere. And I went from being somebody that would hop on any roller coaster to somebody that doesn't even like to get into the car for fear that something will happen to me or happen to them. And that must play a part in it, does it? This protective idea that we have. Yeah. So to think of our babies, albeit them adults, out, you know, living somewhere else in the world outside of our protection. That's hard for us to get our heads around, even though that's what we want for them, as you say, for them to be confident and adventurous.
It is. It's really hard, but it's an internal inside job that we really need to work on ourselves, you know, and that's how I would approach this personally and professionally, like with a client presenting in the same way. My whole lens would be looking at, well, what can we do to bolster up that feeling within you? You know, that feeling of fear that's within you. Because what we don't want is to be transferring that to our kids. Of course, we want them to, you know, it's natural, it's normal. And I think you're right. It starts in the maternity ward. You know, a lot of parents will start to feel fears about things they never did before. Like it could be getting on the plane and all of a sudden that feels like, you know, a real threat. And that is our biology. That's the mama bear inside of us that wants to protect. But we've got to be aware of that. And then we've got to look at, well, you know, how useful is this really? You know, what purpose is it serving really? Because unfortunately, what it can do is actually the opposite. So I remember even years ago, like talking to a parent who was so, it was a client years ago, and she was just so concerned about her child who was maybe only 4 or 5. So it was, you know, a young child, but like frightened that he was going to get hurt on the, you know, playground, you know, just a lot of anxiety around his safety. And I asked the question, like, would you like him to be safe or strong? And she immediately said, safe. And I said, well, how's he going to be safe if he's not strong? So we've got to sort of switch it around, if you like. So the more that we build this strength and this their own ability to navigate the world, the more safe they're going to be. You know, so it's an exercise of trust. It's an exercise of looking deep inside our own selves. What is it in myself that I'm afraid of? Because as parents, we do transfer things. We also transfer our own, you know, I suppose our own childhoods, our own teenage years, what might have gone for us, we're worried might escalate in our own children. If we took risks, then we're worried, you know, that our children will or won't. But essentially, it's this process of really self-discovery. As much as this parent thinks it's about her child leaving home, it's really not. It's much deeper than that. And I think that, you know, the loneliness that she refers to is where I would be very interested in exploring. And it reminds me of a quote that I often use as well with clients, and that is a Carl Jung quote. And he says that loneliness does not come from having no people around us. And I was actually writing about this recently, but from being unable to communicate the things that seem important to us. And this is, Claire, where we really are able to be very open. And it's funny because I was actually writing about this in my Substack, and I actually shared the very thing, you know, about how vulnerable we can feel when we're holding on to things. And this listener has already showed that openness by writing into us. You know, that already shows that there's an awareness there and ability to put words to what she's feeling. But often it's with the people that we love. So, for example, it's been able to say to her daughter, you know, this is how I'm feeling. And it's said in a way that isn't, you know, like, I need you to fix this. Or it's not said with where the emotion is so high. But it's just that ability to have the courage to be open. You know, and I will say that to my son, I'm going to miss you so much, sweetheart. I love you so much, you know, and, you know, I will express that. And it's showing that love, but it's also giving that freedom, you know, not forever a second to stand in their way, but really to be this support with them all the way. And to know that the distance really, it is physical. It's not an emotional distance. It's not like the love stops. It's not like that relationship is in any way over. It's transforming into something different. And another thing that somebody said that really stuck with me, and that is that you want to, as your children, you know, make that transition, is to create a space that they want to come home to. You know, so you want them to feel like they can't wait to get back to see you. And that is where you're creating a life for yourself. And that's the real challenge here for this listener is now she's at a stage where it's like, what can she do to really create that connection, first of all, inside herself, and then to look externally and to view it as the opportunity that it is, so that she has so much, you know, joy and sort of different insights and experiences to share with her daughter. And yeah, they can bond in that way, that they're both kind of on a new journey, really.
Because there is so much letting go with parenting. Something that really resonated with me that I saw online recently was somebody who shared a post that said, nobody told me that every summer I was saying goodbye to that child, because by the next summer, they're very different. Because with each year from, you know, toddler into young child, into adolescent, into teen, you know, really they change every single summer. So it's a constant state of flux. But rather than constantly look back, I try and just embrace what I'm in now. And I'm sure you feel the same if Luca goes to college in France. Yes, there will be a certain grief that he's not there every morning or every evening, and that chapter may be closed for now. But the excitement of you heading off for these weekends in France and maybe exploring the rest of France while visiting him, like we need to stay focused on that. But so much of our identity does get tied up in being a parent and having this person or people need us in that way. So it can be difficult.
It is, exactly, Claire. And that's an important point, is that it is difficult and we can't bypass that. It's like any grief, we can't jump through it. So, you know, that's why I'm saying a lot of the work is internal. So it's this acknowledgement within yourself. Like, I would cry over this, you know, but I'll kind of go through it in my own way, if you like. So I'm working through it so that I know I have the strength then when that time comes. And it sounds like this is an only child. I don't know, but it sounds like it is as well, I think. And the same for Luca, you know, when you have one, it can feel maybe a bit more intense. So it's, context is always important, that when you look at something, that's why I'm saying, you know, she's a single mom, that's context. We cannot compare. We have to look at everything through the lens of the experience that we have. And really for this lovely lady, it's so important to create space for herself to go through that process. There's no way of jumping through it, but acknowledging that there is a heartache, that it is hard, and then that will actually make the path more smooth when it comes. So that's where we get this sort of anticipatory grief comes from. It's quite an intelligent force in many ways that's really helping us, so the shock is not too great when it comes, you know.
Yeah, but that mindset, as you said, is so important, and that's not to take away from the context you mentioned, the challenge, the struggle, the grief that we all, you know, are standing alongside this emailer with. But when your child goes away to college, wherever that ends up, what are you going to do with your time now that you have a bird that you've helped fly the nest, and, you know, and take this time for you? That would be my advice, and maybe seek support with the grief and the challenging parts. Well, Fiona Brennan, sage advice as always. And I know you were half talking to yourself with your own advice there.
And all of us. It's like, that's the real thing, you know, it's like you work through these things ourselves at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Fiona Brennan is founder of The Positive Habit and a clinical hypnotherapist. She has a busy online clinic. For a free sleep time audio, you can go to thepositivehabit.com, and you can find her on Instagram, where she often shares her clinical insights. I'm an absolute super fan of your non-sleep deep rest audio. You're in my ears regularly, Fiona. Thank you so much as ever for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Lara O'Brien is a writing facilitator and an author. Her community writing groups and events have encouraged many to write, and has culminated in a book currently featuring in the top 10 best-selling books in Ireland, The Power of the Prompt. And Lara O'Brien joins me in studio now. Lara, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much for having me, Claire.
And it's not just any community. We're from the same hometown of Howth, although you spread your time between there and the States. So this is the first time our paths have crossed.
It's just funny how it goes, right? But we'll write together soon, Claire.
Sounds amazing. And tell me a little bit about these writing groups that you hold.
Right, so on Friday mornings we meet in person and I'll give the writers a prompt and it's time, so there's no overthinking. They don't know what's coming and they'll just relax and write into whatever comes that's important to them, whatever part of their life story arrives to that prompt, and then they'll read it. So we share our stories, we kind of connect and I'll facilitate, as in I'll give a little feedback on craft, but mainly we're there to support stories, so we're not a critique group. And really what's happened over the last few years is the workshops have become, they've grown. So they've gone from prompts to, and then the writers, of course, have got stronger. And, you know, there came a time when you look at all these people with all these stories, these life stories, and you say, what do we do with them? And that kind of developed then into the idea of Hooks and Reels, which are community events. So we're bringing the writers into the community together. We bring in musicians, local talented musicians that are they're emerging or maybe, you know, moving towards making an EP. We're sponsored by Fingal, so we have a little help with that. We've gone from a number of venues in Howth. We just recently did one for the Howth Sutton Autism Community. So we support other groups as well. We did that in the Yacht Club, but mostly we do our events in, and they've been great, is the Abbey Tavern in Howth. So we do bigger events. They're emceed with Dervil MacDonald, a broadcaster and author and documentary maker. And we had Roddy Doyle, we had Paula Meehan, we had Claire Kofi in the church there as well. And then our smaller events, which are about 70 people, let our writers bring their stories out. And what we found is it's a really bonding, community, warm events for all ages. We have now fans that are in their 80s that come, 90s that have come, and younger teens, you know, maybe a person our age or would bring their parents or their kids. So not too young, but adults. So it's become a real family and warm community event. And we're on our 18th. Our 18th was the launch of the book. And they've just been really well received within the community. And that's kind of what we're happy about. So we wrote about it.
And there's so many elements of that that are so important to our well-being, community, connection. Only last week on the show, we were talking about journaling with our guest, Caoimhe Dufresne, and she was talking about a workshop she's holding weekly where she gives people a prompt. And to be helped to tell your story or get your thoughts on a page is a very healthy endeavour. It's something that can really open up a lot. What's some of the feedback that you've found from people over the years?
The feedback, well, there's a difference, and this is where I see how powerful it is when you actually get your story out of yourself by speaking it. You hear the truth of it. So journaling is great. It's a real start to bring your thoughts from your head to your heart, to your hand. But when you hear your story, you can hear the truth of your story. And you can nearly see people have their own realization as they hear, you know, what stories serves us, what stories need to be, you know, just let go. So there's so much to actually speaking your story. And so that's one. And that's really well supported with a small group. You know, when writers then develop further into their kind of writing craft and then they start to edit and polish and really, you know, they can put a small portfolio of stories together. So they become storytellers. And it's hitting on maybe, I had a lot of issues with dyslexia as a child. And I found that writing really started to help me focus on, well, first focus and then clarity in my own thought process, order of sentences. So when I sit with even 10 people, I can nearly recognize who finds that easy. It's all mental health, really, because you're kind of learning about yourself as you go. But who can really struggles with, you know, thoughts and the thought process? And by just getting it out on the page and then hearing it, it becomes auditory then. You're able to hear your thoughts and you're able to hear your opinions and your values and your emotional scale. So that's where we find the power of the prompt is really rooted in, is in hearing our own stories.
And you're sharing it with other people. As you said, you're not a critique group, so people aren't necessarily holding their hand up and saying, you know, I would have said that differently, or, you know, yes, my cousin's sister had the same experience. They're just listening and holding space. And there's great power in that too.
That's exactly right. And it's a circle. So the more we kind of support or strengthen like your work, and if I hear it in a story, you know, that's fabulous, and I love the way you used your words for that, or that was so lyrical. All the lovely things that we all give back to a story. What we find is, and somebody just said it to me, it was an Amherst method. I didn't know that. But by giving the positive, like the weaknesses start to fall away and people start to strengthen by what they start to understand and learn about their own writing and use that, you know. When I was in the States, I was always writing about Hoth, you know. And I'd talk about the heather on the hills and the lark and the wren or the thrush, the sounds, and bringing nature into your writing. And they'd go, oh, I'd love that. I felt like I was there and they'd never been to Ireland. And I remember going, God, that's great. Like, use that. I'll use that. So you kind of use what your strengths are in writing to get better.
And what's your personal story, Laura? What led you to write and become a facilitator for others?
All of Dr. Gerry O'Brien's land had been sold and the horses all gone. So I was kind of looking for work. I'd only ever worked with horses. I'd never gone to college. And it was, you know, early 90s. There wasn't a whole lot going on in Hoth. And all of our family had got the Morrison visa. So I left for the States, and it kind of broke my heart a little bit because, you know, I wouldn't even go to anywhere in Ireland. It was either Hoth or bust, you know. So when I went to the States anyway, I got a job with Guinness USA. That was great. Ended up happily married, having three kids and going, you know, what is it that I really am born to do? Like, what's the purpose here? Probably an early midlife crisis. I don't know what it was. But my husband said, go write. And as I said, like, I found writing particularly hard in school. And I didn't know what this workshop thing was all about. So I just battled back the voice of the self-critic, the voice of fear. And I kind of jumped in, and I was absolutely stunned by what I found there, because, you know, we were raised with this attitude where, you know, just get on with things. And I was in a room full of people who were literally telling stories of heartbreak and abuse or joy. I mean, it was the full range, but I wasn't quite sure what to make of it all, you know. But I just knew by the end of it was a four-day intense workshop, and I just knew that you can break apart and be put back together again by sharing stories. And I just loved it. And I really just said, I want to be in this space, you know, forever and ever. Amen. I just thought it was absolutely fantastic. So I just went about doing it. I stayed with a mentor, Nancy Erney, on Martha's Vineyard. And also another man, John Hoff Jr., had a workshop. And I was there for 12 years and just learning about, just absorbing it, because there was no class on it. How to facilitate and how to listen and give positive feedback on story to strengthen stories.
And tell me a little bit about Martha's Vineyard then. I was telling you before we came on air here that I've just been listening to Strangers by Belle Burden, a best-selling book, and a lot of it is based around Martha's Vineyard and the connection to nature and community and it being a small island. And even though Hoth was eventually connected by the Tombolo that is Sutton, it is essentially like an island and very community-based. There's actually lots of similarities there.
There really is. And I suppose when I was on this island bringing up kids, and what did community support look like? And, you know, I suppose on the writing, once I got into the writing workshop, what they used to do in the winter time was they would close down this restaurant because it was so cold. People wouldn't go up this rural area for dinner. So they gave it to the artists for the winter. And on Thursday nights, I think it was, people would go. And it was beautiful. They had like, you know, little glass. It was a very French kind of bistro style. And you'd just put your name down on the way in, and the first seven people would get up and read a story. And I just sat there. I was way too nervous, you know. I hadn't really spoken in public since I was asked to read publicly as a child, and was kind of criticised for it because the writing was a bit all over the place. I mean, she was right, but it was just embarrassing. And I hadn't. So when I finally plucked up the courage, I told like this crazy story of being horse thieves coming to the riding stables, and we ended up taking one of the horses and keeping them, and that's how I got my first horse. I was actually became a horse thief. And so anyway, it was kind of one of these stories, and people probably thought it was high fiction, but it was all true. And so, but I'd got through, I'd broken the public speaking kind of seal, and I was nervous. I mean, very nervous, you know, as you probably can remember your first time. But they were warm and encouraging. And I just remember it actually, the seed of everything is encouragement. Like whether it was in the writing or speaking or just keep writing when you think, fuck this, I don't want to write anymore.
And your husband, sometimes you need somebody to say, go write. Whether it's a friend, a colleague, a partner, you know, it's someone to just give you that push that sometimes we don't give ourselves. Before I let you go, tell me about this fabulous book, The Power of the Prompt, Growing a Writing Community, How a Little Scribble Goes a Long Way. This is the culmination of these groups.
Yes, well, it's written over a period of 3 years. So from starting the groups in Howth to, so it's a weave of memoir, part writing guide, and that's also a model for community building. Like you could nearly follow it to create your own version of what we've done in Howth, which is, again, has been a real positive community builder for us. So it's a weave of the three things, but the storyline is really the story of coming back and starting the workshops and just seeing how small acts can really lead to kind of positive things within the community. The workshops, I do retreats. We're just off one yoga writing retreat in Surya Leela in Cadiz. Donald Skeen was there. He survived a gang of women and a lot of stories. And we're going again next March. So writing workshop, it's all on www.lara.com. And now after this month, I go back to the States, back to Martha's Vineyard, and do some book talks from Martha's Vineyard, Newburyport, Maine, and I think DC.
Okay, amazing. Well, I never have somebody on that I haven't read the book. That's just a rule I made with myself, but it only got popped into my door yesterday from somebody within the Howth community. Yeah. Shout out to Tara Mullen.
Yeah, shout out.
And I loved it. I loved the idea. I loved the whole essence of it. So before you headed back stateside, I thought I would nab you. And I'm actually really looking forward to taking my time with this and just enjoying it rather than trying to speed read it between yesterday and today. As you say, people can find out more about all that you do at laraobrien.com. But the book is available in bookstores now.
It's mostly available on a very great Irish platform called buythebook.ie. So it can be ordered there. It's in Books Upstairs. It's in Daha Wellness in Sutton and Reboot in Howth.
All the hot spots.
All the hot spots.
It's called The Power of the Prompt, Growing a Writing Community. Lara O'Brien, continue to grow. And thank you so much for coming on. It was lovely to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me, Claire.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.